Ian, we're doing something this week about cartoons of the EU Commission, which mostly focus on boring grey men in suits drinking wine. I'm just wondering if you've got anything to say about that.
I think it's the cartoonist actually just sublimating his hatred of this office. It's full of boring grey men drinking coffee, mostly.
Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we will be talking about the probation service, privatised by the government a few years ago and which has been recently showing the strain of that decision. We'll also be talking to Richard Jolly, the Eyes cartoonist, who for 15 years has been drawing the euphemisms cartoon, skewering the EU Commission and its various associated bodies. But first, probation. Now, Private Eye's been covering this story for some years now, and the principal correspondent on it is Solomon Hughes. So I sat down with him to ask exactly what's been going wrong and why it's going wrong now. So first of all, I wanted to ask him what exactly the probation service does and what it should be doing.
The probation service, what it does is it tries to direct ex-offenders away from crime. It's a kind of social work for people coming out of prison. So probation services try and get ex-offenders and get them into jobs, into housing and away from crime. Social work, you could call it, but it's also a crime-fighting service. And our current government, apparently the Law and Order Party, thought the best thing to do was hand it over to private companies. Now, what I've looked at most recently is just what's happened in terms of staffing. The government have been asked, they said, how many probation officers are there? You used to publish these statistics when it was national government-run service, but we don't know how many are there. And they said, oh, we don't know either. We know there are sufficient because it says so in the contract, but we don't count them. What I did is just, at one level, it's a simple thing. I went and counted the number of probation officers for them, and we found that everyone knows the probation service is doing badly. It's not going well, and one of the underlying reasons is in these figures. The staff since 2015 have fallen 30%, a third, nearly around 2,700 workers have been cut.
And when we're talking about these workers, are we talking about people who would have been direct probation officers for people who've been in prison, or are we talking about support staff, or is that the whole spectrum, essentially?
It's a bit of both, but I mean, the important thing is this. The government said we don't count it because they've come to an arrangement where they've said, we'll give these big companies the chance to run probation and we'll give them the money. I mean, it's tens and tens and hundreds of millions of pounds to run it, but we won't ask them how many staff they supply. However, because they're private companies, it's possible to go and look at the annual reports of these companies and work out how many staff. They basically give just a total head count. So it's both probation staff and the people who work in the office supporting them and assistants and what have you. One of the things that we had to do in that, or I had to do actually, is add up each one of the companies. Now, the way the privatisation worked is there are 21 separate private probation companies. So I had to add up 21 sets of annual reports over 3 years.
Why are there 21 different companies?
It's an interesting thing. There are 21 regional probation companies, but actually when you look at it, behind them there's probably maybe five big corporations, and it's the familiar bunch. So Dexo, Working Links, Interserve, who may be kind of going bust at the moment in a Carillion-style situation. So it's in JS, it's all the big familiar contractors, most of whom know nothing about probation. Why is it divided up into 21? Well, you know, I think there was a thing back in 2011 where some talks between Francis Maude, who was then a cabinet office minister, sort of in charge of, he's the brain, one of the brains behind Team Cameron, was having talks with the CBI. And he said, there isn't really an appetite, he said, for big privatisations at the moment, because it would make it look like we were naive and handing over big services to profit-hungry corporations. He said that to the head of the CBI. He said, so what we'll have to do is we'll have to think of these privatisations that involve partnerships with other people. Now, the result of that has been is a lot of the Cameron privatisations have been really complicated, involving these supposed partnerships. Now, in reality, if you look at the partnerships, they're pretty small beer. There's one or two extra little social enterprises brought on board, but basically the big corporations still dominate it. So the kind of the worthy reason for this hasn't worked out, but it's left the complexity. And complexity is a great way of hiding things. So just the fact of having to add up 21 different sets of figures. In the end of the day, a journalist can do it, and in the end of the day, one did, which is me. But you'd be surprised how much of a disincentive just even that level of complexity is. You know, or, for example, saying, you know, just that question, are there 21 private probation companies? Well, yes, but in reality there are five. Already we're in a sentence that has a degree of complexity,
yeah.
And it's surprising how easy or how well that works to keep things out the news.
I think that a lot of people, unless you have been in prison or unless you know somebody who's been in prison, probation is a service that a lot of people don't really think about day to day.
I think that's true, and I think that's also helped the privatisation get past. It's a big business. I mean, you're yeah. talking about contracts that are literally hundreds of millions of pounds.
Yeah.
So it's quite expensive because quite a lot of people go to prison and come out of it.
Yeah.
You know, so hopefully as many as possible of those go through probation services. It's quite a crucial one. Like I say, it functions almost like social work. What you're trying to do is monitor prisoners, make sure that they meet their conditions of their probation because they're released before their sentence is up on licence, and to guide them into accommodation and jobs, which is actually quite uphill because,
yeah.
you know, housing for someone who's been in NIC or a job for someone who's been in NIC, that's not easy. And also there's quite important questions about making sure that people who have a history of violence against women, for example, are involved in some kind of program to direct them away from that. People who have been involved with a problem with drugs or involved in some kind of drug rehabilitation and so forth. So it's quite important stuff, which means it's quite bad that it's A, been handed over to a load of big corporations, and B, that they have one of the things they've done is slash staff.
So what does good probation look like, as it were?
Well, A, that's well funded, B, that's run as a national service and not a profit-making service. I mean, one of the problems with the privatisation is it's rather fragmented it, and C, something that integrates well into other services like housing and health services, drug rehabilitation and things of that nature. For the fragmentation, here's a few ways the fragmentation have worked. The first off is I think the government, they knew they could get away with this privatisation, but they were frightened of it a bit as well because some of these people are low-level criminals, some are really dangerous. So they made one decision, which is that they kept the probation for the most serious offenders in a state-run national probation service, and they farmed out the probation of what are viewed as the least serious offenders. It doesn't mean the least, it just means, you know, the not murderous, so on and so forth,
yeah.
To the privatised probation service. And that's been a bad fragmentation. The idea was that all the different companies would come up with new ideas. They have tended to come up with new ideas, and the new ideas have broadly been the same ideas. And those are, one, technological solutions. Some of these sounded quite fancy, computer systems called things like Justice Star. But if you read the probation reports, they aren't really functioning that well, possibly because it's hard to do reform when you're also cutting staff, or possibly because the people who instituted them, a French catering firm like Sodexo or a big general privatiser like Interserve, didn't have any special insight. One big technological solution they've gone for is called the telephone, in that they've very, very consistently, across all the different companies, they've tried to go for telephone-only supervision.
Now, that's different to the old days, how you'd have face-to-face supervision before the privatisation?
Well, exactly, yeah. So they said, oh, here's a better way. So the two ones you've got, one is telephone supervision, and the other one they sometimes talk about, probation suites, a kind of hot desking. So people would just be brought into a kind of hot desk area. You know, so you either supervise people over the telephone or supervise people in not very fixed or private areas. Mm. Both of those, the Chief Inspector of Probations has said they're not on and has really criticised them. And I think the companies have started to pull back from them because this technological solution, cheapskate solution, really, to my mind, has worked very, very badly. And they've been pushed back from that.
One thing you say about the fragmentation is really interesting because there are a lot of parallels with other privatisations here. We did an episode recently about how the National Forensic Science Services had been privatised in the very early days of the coalition. And as a result, individual police forces were now taking more responsibility, meaning that there was no national program controlling all of forensics, and meaning that individual databases will be you know, scattered, and data might get lost.
It's an underlying theme, and I really think it goes back to Francis Maude's point. He was saying that we politically don't believe we can do big, solid single privatisations because it'll look like we're just handing over money to private corporations. Now, as it turns out, these fragmented ones just end up handing money to big corporations, but they do it in a way that's harder to understand. The government's ostensible argument is that this creates more competition and creates the chance to bring in non-profit-making firms and kind of partnerships. But that just really, really hasn't happened. So in the end, you get the worst of both worlds. You get the kind of fragmentation. You don't really get competition. On probation, I mean, this is really interesting. On probation, they did these 21 contracts.
For different regions.
For different regions. And one of the arguments was this would encourage competition. But actually, because they had so many contracts, and there's only so few big firms who want it, several of the contracts were awarded without competition. They were awarded to a single bidder. So London, which is the biggest single probation contract, was awarded to the only company that bid. I mean, they just turned up and got the job. Now, as it happens, they are the only company that have a direct, solid experience in prisons and probation. They're an American company called MTC in a coalition with some British companies, but a really terrible one. One of their prisons, which was a prison made of tents, that's a very American-style thing, in Texas. So it's a prison made of tents behind barbed wire in Texas, which mostly held immigrants who were in some form of detention, migrants to America. It burnt to the ground in 2015. It was such horrible conditions that the inmates were just permanently angry. You know, they didn't like living in tents. They were cold, they were horrible, they were hot, they were horrible. The food was disgusting. They were pushed around. And in the end, this led to a riot where the whole thing burnt down. Now, I don't know how that works, where you think, I need somebody to run this British service, which maybe is not perfect, but it's running along. I think I'll get the American company that ran a tent prison that burnt to the ground.
You briefly mentioned the name of Sodexo there.
Sodexo are quite big, and I don't think they're doing particularly well. Interserve are quite big. They're a company, I don't know if they're super well known, but they're quite a big general privatiser. They're quite similar to Carillion. They have a kind of construction-y feel and also a private services feel. We've got Ingeus, which was really came to us, and Working Links also, that also really came to us out of the welfare to work programmes. The probation privatisation is quite heavily modelled on the welfare to work schemes of the last government, which also were marked by poor performance by contractors, waste of money, and also ending up a bit of a money pit. If you don't really run your own probation service, you hand it to someone else. You don't get a lot of competition in their companies where arguably the records aren't good. Halfway through, and this is what happened, halfway through they said, we're having trouble doing this, it's ever so expensive and we're not doing very well. And the inspection reports were coming in saying, oh, this doesn't look good. So they said, well, what's the answer? And they all queued up and they said, well, we'll walk away from the job unless you give us money. I mean, that's an extrapolation of mine. And so the government's answer was, looking at these big corporations saying we're doing the job badly, we want more money, was, well, the answer should be, go away, we'll do it ourselves. But instead, of course, the answer was, we'll give you £277 million bailout.
So this is another story that we need to cover, because this has been in the eye several times.
Yes.
There was a small bailout divided among the four or five firms that we've been talking about. And that was last year, and that was early last year. It was for about £22 million.
Yeah.
Now, you've just named the figure of £277 million. Pounds. Can you just explain exactly why being given to these companies?
The way it happened, well, actually, in the end, now they're even being given more. But we'll start with the little and the big figures. We could see in early 2017 that, look, they're begging for more money, and the history of this government is they're going to give them more money. So we could see that was happening. And then suddenly the then Justice Minister, David Lidington, he wrote a 600-word open letter about probation, which he said, the system has encountered unforeseen challenges. We all foresaw the challenges, but he was admitting things were going wrong.
Yeah.
And he said in that letter, he said that he had adjusted the company's contracts to reflect more accurately the cost of providing critical frontline services. Now, that is just a completely bland phrase, but there was nowhere in there. There wasn't a footnote that said this is what the new contracts are worth, or this is what we can do, or we expected this much. But there was a reference in some of the paperwork to the fact that if you change a big public sector contract in the same way as if you put a big public sector contract up for bid, you have to publicise it through the European Union for competition rules. The official journal of the European Union carries all big state contracts. The idea is it's to give everyone a fair chance in the EU of bidding for them. But in this case, it was just an adjustment. But same rules, they had to publish these contracts in the official journal of the EU. So what it meant was, to work out how big the bailout was, I had to go to the official journal of the European Union, get, again, it's 21 contracts, stick them in my 21-line spreadsheet and work out. And they had to say the value of the bailouts there. Now, they did it in two tranches. They did it one for about 20 million and then one for 277 million.
So these four or five firms, they went to the government and they said, we're not able to make a profit on the contracts that we've been awarded. Is that correct?
Well, they said they were having difficulty. I mean, if you look at the accounts of the companies, some of them have continued to make profit throughout this period. Some have made a loss, some have made a profit, which I always thought, when you're a business, if you tout for something, that's what happens.
You might make a profit, you might make a loss.
That's the market, isn't it? So the rules of the market would say, okay, these companies, some have said that they want to do the job and they're making a profit. Some are making a loss. Well, you deal with it. And so some companies pull out of the business, some companies expand. If it really was the rules of the market, that would happen. So basically, they just asked for more money. You can dress it up whichever way you want it. They didn't have a way of proving that. They were just saying, we want more money.
Is there kind of a too big to fail element or philosophy going on? As in, if this goes past, as we saw with Carillion earlier in the year, this would be disastrous and we'll have to spend a lot of money patching it up.
I think so. I'm not convinced it would have necessarily cost a lot more money or been disastrous. It's too big to fail because they don't believe it should fail. Mm. You know, I mean, it is that classic thing of where you say, okay, we're going to contract things out to the market. The free market competition will bring efficiency. When it doesn't, you end up saying, well, it's parastatals, maybe. It's you end up with a situation where these large corporations are just feeding off taxpayers' money without competition. You've got private non-competition instead of state non-competition.
Do you think there's an intrinsic reason why competition couldn't work or couldn't improve probation?
I think there's a few things. I think the first is, which has been the underlying problem with the privatisation of hospitals or schools, is that really for competition fully to work, you need something to be actually ready to have something go bust. Mm. You know, if you want competition in shoes to work, you really need the successful shoe company to succeed, but the unsuccessful one to fail. And in a way, it's quite difficult. You can't really let a hospital go bust. You can't really let probation services go bust. So those essential services, there is an inherent difficulty. Now, of course, you can still do some things. You might want to contract out not in a sort of big bang way, which the government's way of doing it in the fragmented way pretends to be this. But, you know, not do that. If you wanted to say, if a probation services might run kind of welfare to work elements, ex-offenders being involved in some kind of job scheme, you could perhaps get a charity to do that, or you might get a private company to do that. You could try that out. But if you do that at a lower level, so if you know that if that fails, you can take it back and give it to someone else. I mean, that seems to me that's fairly basic, isn't it? It's if you own your house and you want some private people to come around and fix the radiators, that's pretty normal. But if you own your house and you say, I know, it'd be much better if I sold it and decided to rent houses from then on. I mean, they're both ways of private approaches to housing management. What the government has done is it's kind of sold its house in order to rent it back.
So we've got a situation where a third of staff have been cut, people are being supervised over the phone more, and the firms that have won these contracts have been awarded more money, which hasn't really been openly declared. But they've been awarded more money to keep delivering on the contract that they signed in 2015. What happens next to these big contracts?
Well, at one level, they've hit yet another crisis. So it looks like things might change. But then again, it looks like they won't. What happened is in the latest iteration of this, Justice Secretary David Gork announced, it's not running right. I appreciate that. So we're going to have to end the contracts early in 2020.
And they were meant to run until 2022, we should say. It was going to be a 7-year contract, 2015 to 22. So they're ending in 2020.
Yes, when okay. they should have ended in 2022. But he's ending them early. You think, oh, right, then maybe the government's going to take them back. But no, what he's really saying is two things. First, he's going to end them in 2020 in order to re-tender them. So it's just going to go out. Nobody else is looking for these jobs. It's just these big corporations who are doing it. It's the same old gang. Now, he'll re-tender it. I think there's very likely that it'll reduce the number. So it'll be even smaller number of, you know, maybe one or two will drop out. So it'll reduce the number of big corporations. But it won't change the fundamentals. It actually will make it worse. And in the process of shortening their contracts, he gave them another bailout. What he said was, you know, well, look, we're shortening your contracts, but also that means that all those penalty clauses that would have said you don't get money because you didn't do this, or you only get all the benefit clauses that I said you only get money because you would have done that, they were all scratched out. So it's like, here's another over 100 million quid. So, you know, we think it's a bit hard to say because you only know at the end of the day when all the jobs are done. But we think the current bailout is probably running around 500 million pounds. So that's quite a lot of money. It goes to why the story is underreported. I mean, we've reported it. Our editor, Ian Hislop, believes that our readers out there have quite a high tolerance for detail. They've got a high tolerance for hearing us. The sound of a hammer banging in a nail, I suppose, is one way of looking at it. They have a high tolerance for stories like that, and I'm very grateful for that. I hope that's true. It's certainly we get the space to do it, but it means we've been able to bang away, bang away, and bang away at this. At the same time, it's very, very, very underreported in the... I'm not saying there's a really good panorama on probation privatisation, but it's still underreported when you're talking about, here's a 500 million quid extra. There you go, mate. That's a big story, a bad story, and unfortunately, a story which it looks like will keep me in work beyond 2020.
Your spreadsheet's going to be updated for a while yet, I think.
It is, yeah, yeah. I mean, the only difficulty then is gets to, you know, how do you find something new to say when it's, oh my God, they're doing the same thing again. Bangs head on desk.
And you can read Solomon banging his head repeatedly on the desk in the latest edition of Private Eye, and in many future editions, subscriptions are also available. Now, we turn to the E-Euphemisms cartoon. Richard Jolly has been writing and drawing the cartoon for the past 15 years, and has relied in that time on the classic formula of what people say as opposed to what they really mean. It's a classic gag, and as Richard reveals, it goes all the way back to the days of Yes Minister. Here's Richard.
I used to read the Yes Minister books when I was a kid. Yes Minister books from the TV that were actually really, really good. There was a section where they did a whole bit of what civil servants say, what they really mean. And basically this is that idea, with a cartoon on it as well.
That's very honest of you to fess up. So 15 years is a very long time for a strip to be running. And the kind of things you're doing, so there's one recently. There's a man at a podium and he's summarised the whole summer of talks, and what he's saying is, we are reiterating the urgent need to find solutions to the problems of Brexit. And at the bottom, what he means is, because we still haven't actually come up with any ourselves. So that's the idea in a nutshell, basically. Yeah. So what you're saying, in effect, is that this is a cartoon largely about diplomacy.
Europe is. I mean, that's why it's a what they say, what they mean. Because a lot of the language they use is diplomatic language. Obviously, because when you're dealing with foreign countries, you have to use diplomatic language. At the same time, they are taking large amounts, or have been and probably still will be, taking large amount of money off and handing it over to wherever. Sometimes they don't even know, and that kind of thing. So they have an effect of a direct financial and fiscal domestic policy effect on us, while still being expected. But then they're rolling out red carpets and drinking champagne and this kind of. I often draw them in the cartoons all drinking wine and that kind of. I often put glasses of wine.
A lot of glasses of wine.
That
yeah.
kind of thing. That's because once, there a few years ago now, I was watching Newsnight and there was a scandal that it was revealed that the bottles of wine that the EU had with their lunch at this big summit were £150 each. And the reporter was interviewing the French delegate, and we said, well, what bottles of wine are £150 each? And the French delegate just looked at him and went, but we must drink wine. And, you know, sort of right there and then, Marie Antoinette-ed the entire EU kind of thing. And that was such a lack of understanding. You don't have to drink wine at lunchtime. You don't have to drink £150 bottles of wine. If you do, feel that you have to drink a £150 bottle of wine at lunchtime. You could pay for it yourself. And that lack of understanding. So ever since then, I've put bottles of wine on the table.
Do you know, I've never consciously registered the bottles of wine, unless it's a cartoon about someone being drunk. But I'm looking through a few of the old ones now, and there they
are. I try to put a bottle of wine somewhere. Sometimes, because the cartoons can look incredibly samey, I leave them. I haven't put them in for a couple of weeks. But I quite often just put a little glass of wine just in the corner. And that's because of that French delicate of what he said.
But the fact that it's been going for 15 years means this predates Brexit by a very long way.
Quite a long way, yeah.
And they're now almost all about Brexit. Well, obviously, the dominant story.
Each week I look at, each fortnight rather, I look at whatever's in the news. And hopefully the best ones are when somebody has actually genuinely said something ludicrous. If not, then you can have a look at the general issues that are going on. The very second EU function I ever did was about making an appointment in Brussels, and it was about them saying, you are the perfect candidate, and it translated as, congratulations, you're a middle European non-entity. And since then, we've had Herman von Rompuy and Juncker, and all these people have come, and you're kind of going, well, they're still doing the same jokes. The real thing is that nothing does change, and that's kind of the joke, really. You could just draw the same cartoon with the guy getting slightly older and more tired each fortnight, and it being absolutely the same joke, because it's part of the joke that they don't have to change, because there is not enough checks and balances to make them change. But then as a result of that, because they don't change, I'm still writing the same things as I was 15 years ago.
Do you dream of there actually being changed and there being a new cartoon for you to draw?
That would be a very big dream.
Okay, so the sameness thing is really interesting because it's quite a tricky subject for a cartoonist, because you've said that the issues go back 15 years, and you've been kind of, you know, dealing with the same linguistic stuff for 15 years. You've also got the problem that you mostly have men in suits.
I occasionally put a woman in, but the fact that they're all dull looking, I always put glasses on them so you can't see their eyes. They're all in the same suit. They usually have the same tie on. Occasionally someone has a spotty tie, but usually they have the same stripy tie. And there's always an unnecessary EU flag. Although, of course, that's not the EU flag. The EU doesn't have a flag. That's what they always say. That's why I always put EU flags on it, because the EU doesn't actually have... That's the flag of the Council of Europe.
Yeah.
And they often make that... They invented an EU flag. It looked like a barcode. It was all the different colours of all the different flags of Europe, all put in. It was hideous. It looked like a pair of pyjamas or something, and they don't use it. They carry on using the flag of the Council of Europe. But if asked, they say they don't have a flag and they don't have an anthem.
Okay.
But they fly that flag that's not the EU flag, it's the Council of Europe flag, and Ode to Joy is not the EU anthem, that's the Council of Europe. But they play that all the time. So you go, well, okay, it kind of is your anthem, and that is your flag.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I've got one here which has got three little EU Council of Europe flags in it. So it's a conscious choice to make them all the same, to emphasise the repetition of what they're doing.
But then you have to try and make them as different as possible so that it's not exactly the same picture each week.
They're all quite ill-shaven too. A lot of them are. Very stubbly.
I started doing that a few years ago just because I noticed... I don't want to draw sort of Euro stereotypes or anything in the cartoons, but I did notice little things like in Europe they wear slightly different shaped glasses often and that kind of thing. And a lot of their politicians are unshaven. They do have more beards. Pretty much most of our male politicians are very clean shaven. So
I mean, the amount of thought that goes into it is really interesting.
I've been doing it every fortnight for 15 years. You end up, I mean, it's not that much. I've been able to put the amount of thought into the last 10 minutes of talking. So it's not that much thought over 15 years. But you do notice things and think, well, I should put that in and that kind of thing.
The previous euphemisms, you know, before Brexit reared its head, were more, I guess, about the internal affairs of Europe.
And
you know, about whatever it might be, corruption or about a slight lack of democracy.
Yeah.
Are you really looking forward to getting back to that once the whole question of Britain and Europe is resolved in March, as it will be, and we all stop talking about it?
I think generally that everybody who's working in any aspect of the news would quite like to not be talking about Brexit quite so much. At the same time, I mean, constantly talking about corruption isn't much fun either. So, you know.
Are you concerned that once we're out, that'll be curtains for EU euphemisms?
I don't know. That's up to the... I mean, we've still got... I mean, I don't know. A bit, but, you know, it's got to have a shelf life on it eventually. But at the same time, I mean, Brexit's taking so long. I mean, they're talking about the transition period being till 2022. Mm. I mean, I might not last that. I mean, I might go before Brexit.
This is the other interesting thing, is that it's a voice of Euroscepticism. Mm. Are you trying to represent a side? Do you?
No, not really. I wouldn't call myself Eurosceptic. I don't really like having a label on. It's not meant to be political in that way. Yeah. I mean, they are a tier of government that has influence over us, has influence over me, has influence over you. They can mess up your life or they can make it better. You have to be sceptical about that if you're in satire. You can't just say, oh, no, I love Europe because I went on holiday once and it was sunny. Therefore, they can, you know, elect anyone they want to mess with our industries. You have to be sceptical about it. That doesn't necessarily mean that, there's always someone in charge, and it's always important to be sceptical about them. You should also be Brexit sceptical. The people running Brexit, a similar bunch to the people who were running Europe. They're not the great heroes who've come sweeping in. One of the things I think that's weird about Brexit is that it's almost Shakespearean in how it's affected politics. And in Julius Caesar, Cassius and Brutus swap personalities. Well, in the old days, pre-Brexit, one of the big differences in the debate was always the Europhiles were always talked in very highfalutin terms about peace and the future in Europe and brotherhood and this kind of thing. You know, they would talk about there hasn't been a war and this kind of thing. And the Eurosceptics were always very much picky and bitty and saying, well, no, what about this? And how's this industry working? How's that happening?
Bendy bananas.
Yeah, exactly. And Hoovers and things like that. And then we had Brexit, and suddenly now the leavers who were the Eurosceptics are all, unto the sunny uplands of freedom and independence. And the Remainers, who were the Europhiles, are all going, but what about point 36B? In the, how are we going to affect, how will this affect the fishing industry and this kind of thing? They've swapped sides. And they're now both arguing in a different way. You know, the people who would at one point have been very, very, they're messing with our beans industry in South Shields and that kind of thing, are now turned into Poundland Churchill's talking very, very, very pompously about the great future and that kind of thing. But obviously, despite the fact everything's turned on its head, it's still exactly the same. You know, everything is always going to be slightly rubbish. So, and Europe's no different. You can mix with the how we actually implement the slight rubbishness, but you won't stop it being slightly rubbish.
That is pretty much a motto for the whole magazine. Everything's always going to be slightly rubbish.
Yeah, I think so.
That's the best we can hope for.
Well, yeah.
Richard Jolly there. And if you'd like to read more accounts of how slightly rubbish the world is and always will be, Private Eye is available in all good newsagents. That's it for this episode of Page 94. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it. We'll be back again in a fortnight with another one. Goodbye.